Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. Good evening, I'm Joseph Pache. On tonight's show with guest host David Boyer, we'll do a deep dive in what can be done about the Bay Area's homelessness crisis with two experts, Tamiqua Moss, founder and director of the nonprofit All Home, and Jamie Almanza, executive director of Bay Area Community Services.
Then co-host Ethan Elkind speaks with the San Francisco artist Jennifer K. Wofford about her new mural in the Civic Center.
But first, let's check in on the state of the San Francisco School Board with Mission Local Managing Editor Joe Eskenazi.
I'm hearing an echo of myself.
I think it's fair to say that, like many of us, the San Francisco School Board has been having a bit of a rough year.
I would say so. Mission Local Managing Editor Joe Eskenazi joins us to talk about the state of San Francisco School Board. Welcome to the State of the Bay, Joe.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, welcome back, actually. The San Francisco School Board has found itself in the hot seat a number of times this year, some would say over a bonfire entirely over their own making. Joe, catch us up on a year in the life of this school board.
Well, I mean, where do you want to begin? A lot of people got very worked up about the amount of time and resources and energy a couple of years ago spent discussing the murals at George Washington High School. That was back when, you know, that was something that you could even consider spending that much time doing. And in the end, the school board was actually overruled, and the murals continue to exist, at least for now. Since the pandemic started, the school district has been extremely slow in first adopting transparent plans to reopen schools and then enacting those plans. They have also voted to rename 44 schools, which was controversial on its face, but even more so when the process was deeply flawed and relied upon ahistorical analysis of the naming committee, and that invited a lawsuit. That the school board may duck by undoing this process. They undid the merit-based entry exams to get into Lowell High School, opening it up just to be a lottery in the name of more racial equity. And finally, most recently, school board member Allison Collins, people who were opposed to the Lowell renaming and wanted her gone, managed to unearth tweets she made in 2016 that were at best insensitive to Asian people, at worst racist, and her reaction when confronted with it was not good. And now every official in San Francisco wants her to resign, and she has sued the school board and five of her colleagues, claiming a conspiracy against her.
And let's not forget San Francisco's own city attorney sued the school district.
That did happen.
That's right. And it was struck down, I believe, last week by a judge. Is that right?
He is not able to get an injunction. Okay. There are still avenues to take, but at this point, I think it's a moot process, considering that, the first children are coming back as soon as a week from today.
And also there's a recall effort underway against several members of the school board.
Yes, that is happening.
All right. Well, before we dig into all these scandals, we need to ask the question that's probably on every parent's mind. What is the reopening plan for San Francisco schools?
Well, starting next week on the 12th, we are going to start having smaller children come in between 2 to 5 days a week. Then there's another wave coming in on the 19th, and gradually all of the young people will be coming back in. As for what school means, some of them are only coming in, you know, a couple days a week. My understanding is because of a shortage of teachers, some of them are coming on site to then be remote schooled. And I don't know exactly what the picture is with older school children. So it's greatly uncertain. And, you know, a lot of parents have a lot of decisions to make up to June and looking at next year.
So, Joe, one of our reporters here at KLW, Annalise Finney, is working on a story about a meeting held last June when the board voted down a plan to hire a consultant to help them with the reopening plan. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's something that, that looms large right now, and it was something that, in hindsight, is a difficult decision to defend. My understanding is that this particular consultant, and this would have been paid for with grant money, so it wasn't coming out of the school's operating budget per se, this particular consultant had worked with charter schools, and that was a disqualifier among enough of the school board members who did not want to work with this person. I don't think that there was, I'm not sure there was an adequate plan B, and that certainly seems to have played out over the past year.
And do you see that as a missed opportunity, or, you know, is it hindsight that we're looking at and saying this was an important meeting, or do you really feel like that was sort of where things went off the rails officially?
I think that we can look at this and say that it's a very difficult decision to defend, knowing what we now know. We do not know if this consultant would have had all the answers, and we do not know how well his or her suggestions would have been followed. So it's hard to say for certain that that, you know, that would have saved everybody's bacon. But, you know, other school boards hired consultants. But, you know, the least charitable view you could take is that this guy didn't pass the purity test, and therefore, you know, was therefore shown the door, separate and apart from the need for this and the qualifications of this individual.
And, you know, there was also an election in November, one of the most active elections, I think, in board history. Do you think that being in the middle of an election figured into any of the dysfunction, quote unquote, dysfunction last year? And I'm also curious that the two new commissioners, how has their presence impacted, you think, the board?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the board has a very, I think that. Well, let's put it this way. I mean, we don't elect school board commissioners to run schools during a pandemic. And if it wasn't a pandemic, you know, we might have ideological disputes with them. And, you know, it might be something along the lines of the Washington High School murals. That's not what's going on right now. The very few of the school board members are doing things differently than what they campaigned on. You know, if you were opposed to Lowell changing its admissions policy, you should have campaigned harder for people who said they wanted to keep things the way they were. Commissioners like Collins and some of her and many of her colleagues, this is what they campaigned on, and so that's not a surprise. What has been, I think, you know, most galling to people is the sclerotic nature of opening the schools and or even coming up with a plan or communicating that plan. The communications between the district and the parents have been abysmal. And I can tell you this as a reporter and as a parent. It's very hard to know what's going on. And when there's a lack of a decent communications, you know, other things fill that vacuum. And that includes rumors and online back and forths and what have you. So I think the pandemic is really, you know, putting people in a position that they ought never to have been in. Some of these people might have been perfectly acceptable commissioners or at least it wouldn't have been the end of the world, and you wouldn't have known who your school board commissioners are. But things change in this kind of situation.
Well, and those two new commissioners, I'm just curious, do you feel like they brought any sort of fresh ideas to the table or anything that notable?
I mean, not to denigrate them, but not really. I mean, there were enough. These aren't close votes. I mean, all of the votes have been very lopsided. So, and things have been moving around. And for all the people who say, "Oh, if only the mayor's appointee, mayor could appoint everybody," you know, the two commissioners who were appointed by the mayor before their election, they all voted for the renaming. And you know, one of them voted to do away with merit-based admission at Lowell. So it goes deeper than that.
So let's go to that topic. Change in the admissions process for Lowell. What is the controversy about it, and how did it turn out, this being the first year that the new lottery system was applied?
Well, the first year that the new lottery system was applied, at least demographically, looking at it on paper, it worked out as people would have wanted it to, and we're going to have to see how things go from here. But, you know, the number of Latino students went way up, and the number of African-American students went way up. And it is, I mean, and as a result, I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe it's a lower percentage Asian, and I believe it is a lower percentage white, though I can't attest to that. You know, Latinos and African Americans have always been underrepresented at Lowell High School, and you know, it's hard to say that. This gets into a very uncomfortable discussions very quickly, and those are the kinds of discussions that when unearthed and put in an ungraceful manner got Allison Collins into so much trouble regarding behaviors of an entire race and culture of people. But suffice to say, you can look at the demographics and see that certain groups have always been underrepresented at Lowell, and standardized tests and the entry mechanisms. These are not infallible. You know, they were not taken down from Mount Sinai. And so certainly it isn't off base to say we need to rejigger these or look into what we're trying to do here. Years from now, we'll be able to see if people have equitable outcomes. And that's, that's something that you can't do immediately. But at least on the face of it right now, the numbers of underrepresented students did go up.
So walk us through how Allison Collins' tweets emerged, those from 2016. And you also recently wrote in Mission Local that the unanimity of voices in San Francisco is calling for her resignation, which is practically unprecedented. And it ties into the decision to make Lowell not based on exams but on lottery, right? It's kind of all connected.
Yes, there are connections there. What happened is people who were vehemently opposed to this move began looking around for through her social media, of which she is a prolific tweeter. And they found a series of tweets from December of 2016 in which she lamented anti-black attitudes among Asians. And while this is there's plenty in the series of tweets that, is warranting discussion and is something that, people can have a level-headed discussion about, these tweets went into a place where there were people could argue that there were generalizations here that played into anti-Asian tropes and described people very broadly. And if you hadn't been describing Asians and had been describing, African-Americans or Jews or Muslims, you'd be in a lot of trouble immediately. And, many of the Asian people I spoke with were upset that we were even, soft-pedaling it. Why is it always that we question the racism when it's Asians that we're talking about? In this case, I think that the real capper for Allison Collins was how she handled it in the present day. The Asian American leaders and district members, elected leaders, etc., that contacted her said either that they were blown off or that she was very defensive and unapologetic. And that is not meeting the moment, as Governor Newsom would say. Both politically and empathetically and just, handling yourself with common decency at a time when Asian Americans are feeling for their lives and well-being on the city's streets, you need to handle this a little differently. And it doesn't just mean saying you're sorry when you're not sorry. It means listening and being empathetic and trying to describe what you were trying to say and not apologizing because someone took it wrong or didn't, or is upset. You actually have to do more than that. And that was a resounding failure. And that's why every last elected official in the city pretty much is calling for her to resign. And that's also a strategic move, because the longer Allison Collins sticks around, the more that, people who are not already extreme partisans and extremely devoted to getting her and others off the board will sign on to that effort. This is like a French Laundry moment for that. And, that was a calculation among many elected officials when they wanted her to get out of the picture. She did quite the opposite. She sued the district and sued her colleagues. I've seen many lawsuits in my 25 years of journalism, and I've never read a lawsuit like that before. And neither had the constitutional law experts that I spoke with.
What was different about it?
Of the bizarre lawyering and bizarre recasting of the facts in a nonsensical way, to put it mildly. It strikes me as a very bizarre lawsuit. All of the First Amendment and 14th Amendment claims are extremely dubious, but also there are claims in there basically accusing her colleagues of launching a conspiracy against her, that it seems to be confused between her colleagues on the board and the people, the online Lowell High School merit-based partisans who dug up this stuff and threw it out there. That's when you're asking for $87 million in damages, as this suit does, I think it would behoove you to know who you're suing. And there seems to be confusion on that point.
So just to note, though, the president of the school board, Gabriela Lopez, was the only other member of the school board besides Collins to not join forces and asking Collins to step down. What's that about?
Because she I believe that they are allies, and you know, I can't really speak to why Gabriela Lopez feels that way. You know, it spared her from being a defendant in this suit. I can't really speak to why she feels the way she feels, and certainly conversations about this are going to be muted now that there's an $87 million lawsuit leveled against the school district and the majority of the board.
So we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But I'm curious about the renaming of the 44 city schools. Spent a lot of time on it, and then they put the plan on hold last month. Did the decision to actually put it on hold surprise you in any way?
No, it didn't. I think that it was a sensible decision, because this is not the time to be putting resources into that. And I think that you don't have to be ideological one way or the other to think that. This is a decision that, you know, that we don't need to be spending time on right now, separate and apart from the process, which I think everyone will now admit is lacking. And that's not to say that some of these names shouldn't be changed. In fact, I think the majority of them, you could come up with very good arguments to change them. But that doesn't need to happen right now. You don't need to worry about the logo on the side of the plane when you're trying to avoid the mountain. And at this point in time, these schools need to be open, and we need to have a scope of normalcy, and kids need to be getting educated. And then you can talk about this. The lawsuit, takes issue with the process and takes issue with notifications. And, you know, once you've got Lawrence Tribe on board, who turns out to be a Lincoln High alum and seems enamored of Abraham Lincoln, I think there's a good chance, and I think that the board will vote tomorrow whether to basically scuttle this and come back to it with a whole new effort.
So I'm curious, you know, there's obviously plenty of drama all year long and all of last year. But when you sort of look at the big picture, is San Francisco really that far behind other districts when it comes specifically to reopening schools? Yes, there's drama, but when you look at other districts that are comparable, are we that far behind in San Francisco?
We are behind, and there are reasons for that. But I think that the problem here is that the explanations have not been forthcoming. And I think that this has become more political than it had to be. I mean, essentially, if we could start on the same page of saying, ideally, what we want to do is to get everyone back into school as soon as it's recommendable. And here's what we need to do. And here's what's getting done. And here's what isn't. This would be a different situation. These conversations have become muddled. And in San Francisco, I don't think we've extracted the same layer. I mean, we have a great degrees of uncertainty heading into the next few weeks and months, and even into next year. We don't know what the school is going to look like, and I think that this uncertainty is playing havoc with people's well-being, students and parents. And I also feel that I think we've given a little bit too much short shrift to the careers. I think describing this in the terms that we have about the sensibilities of people who need to earn a living, and claiming that this is just the bastion of white privileged people is incredibly insulting. Not just to white privileged people, but this is mostly, let's be frank, it's mostly women's careers which are being derailed or worse. Because of an inability of children to go to school. And so I think that playing that off as some kind of small concern or concern only of those who are best off is self-defeating. To answer your question, I don't know that we're that much further behind, but we are further behind, and our path is more opaque.
Well, Joe, I have a feeling we'll be having you back on to talk about this in the months that come. But thank you so much for joining us today.
I hope I have a clearer path to talk to you about, and I hope it's all good news from here on.
Sounds good.
And I just want to make mention that KLW is a licensee of the San Francisco Unified School District, and we carry school board meetings on the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month, so you can tune in for those. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll have a conversation with two nonprofit leaders to talk about solutions to the homelessness crisis, Tamiqua Moss and Jamie Almanza.
And if you have any questions or suggestions on what to do about the Bay Area's homelessness crisis, we want you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call with questions or comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message at Twitter at State of Bay. Now on State of Bay, we're going to take a closer look at the Bay Area's homelessness crisis. During the pandemic, homeless encampments have multiplied as shelters have had to cut their number of beds to allow for social distancing. Cities like San Francisco have placed thousands of unhoused people in hotels temporarily, but that funding is going to go away in a few months. And despite all of the money that's been spent by cities and state, many residents in the regions feel like the situation is only getting worse.
Before I introduce our guest tonight, I want to give a disclaimer or disclosure, I guess. I work for the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and I work with people experiencing homelessness. My appearance here on State of the Bay does not represent the views of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. With that out of the way, let me introduce our two guests tonight to talk about regional solutions to the homelessness crisis. Tamiqua Moss is the founder and chief executive of the nonprofit All Home. She has worked on this issue for 20 years in the nonprofit sector and as an aide to mayors in both San Francisco and Oakland. Welcome, Tamiqua.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also we have Jamie Almanza, Executive Director of Bay Area Community Services, or BACS. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks so much.
So, Tamiqua, I wanted to start with you. You've worked both in San Francisco and Oakland City Government, and you founded All Home. Tell us a bit about your work and what it means to take a regional approach to homelessness.
It's a great question. I have been working in the Bay Area now for almost 18 years on housing security, economic justice, housing justice, and having worked in both cities and really taking a broader approach around people experiencing homelessness aren't bound by city and county boundaries. Folks are looking everywhere in our region to find affordable housing that they can afford.
Can you hear me?
They're looking for safe schools.
I went on for a radio appearance. And I am embarrassed as hell to say I realize I forgot to bring
so
up.
They're looking for a variety of things.
Unresigning when they asked me to run.
Yeah. Sorry, Joe. It sounds like Joe Eskenazi is still with us. I'm sure he's riveted by this topic. But, Joe, we're going to ask you to take yourself off the air so we can continue with our program.
It's live radio, people. Live radio.
All right. So, Tamiqua, I'm so sorry for interrupting you there. Go ahead.
I was just saying that having, you know, worked on these issues across cities and counties, it became really clear to me that our solutions to homelessness are not bound by our city and county boundaries. And in fact, part of the challenge that we have is that we don't have integrated systems that work with people no matter where they are in the Bay Area to help resolve their homelessness crisis. And so I started All Home with the intention of bringing together our entire ecosystem, our community-based organizations, our public and private sector partners, incredible leaders like Jamie, right, to really think about what do we need to do to elevate the best practices of the things that we know work? How do we really dismantle the bureaucracy that limits our ability to coordinate and align our policies and resources? And how do we then take some joint accountability around what the region actually needs with respect to addressing the homelessness and housing crisis? So that was the sort of motivation to launch All Home as a regional entity that was truly designed to support excellent work that's already happening to fill gaps where we don't have strategies and resources, and also to make firm commitments about an overall population level reduction to homelessness in our region.
So, Jamie, your organization's focused on direct services. Tell us a bit about BACS and how the pandemic has specifically affected your clients.
Sure. So BACS, Bay Area Community Services, was founded in 1953 here in Oakland. We're in seven counties across the greater Bay Area. Like you said, we provide a ton of direct services. So we serve over 10,000 individuals and families per year. We provide every kind of spectrum of the intervention, everything from navigation centers, street outreach, all the way through permanent supportive housing. The pandemic, when it started, we doubled down. You know, many organizations had to kind of convert to remote working. And for anyone that knows what it's like to do a Zoom call, imagine doing that from a tent. And so as an organization, it became very clear to us that our direct service workers had to not only provide services and provide them safely. We were very fortunate to get donations of protective equipment very early on. We had to step in to provide services very at the very start of the pandemic all the way through.
Yes, Joseph, please.
Yeah, so Tamika, how would you describe how the region as a whole has confronted homelessness in this current year of the pandemic, but especially over the last decade? What's worked? What hasn't?
Again, another great question. You know, one of the examples that I like to lift up where regionalism really mattered was actually in the Bay Area's response to COVID. We had our health county health leaders come together ahead of the nation, actually, to figure out how they needed to coordinate their efforts, what they needed to do in terms of messaging and communication to get the word out to keep people safe around the pandemic. And I use that example because it's analogous to what we need to do with respect to the homelessness and housing crisis. We know it works. We know that the pandemic has relaxed a lot of barriers that would have prevented jurisdictions from working together in the past because we needed to act urgently. Lives were at stake. Well, I would contend that lives continue to be at stake. Homelessness was not a crisis that was born out of the pandemic. This was a crisis that we were having before the pandemic and, as you said, decades prior. So one of the things that I think has worked is that the region is starting to recognize that no one city, no one organization, no one community can do it on its own. We have now experienced in the Bay Area, from my perspective, one of the most significant affordability crises of our time. And that is affecting more and more people every day. And so when you look at who's most directly impacted at the lowest end of our economic spectrum, people earning 0 to 30% of the area median income, people who are currently calling the streets home, we have to really think more strategically and comprehensively about what are the interventions that are working. We actually know how to rehouse people. Jamie's organization does it every day. Hamilton Families, where I used to lead their work, we know how to rehouse people and get folks back into housing. But what we haven't been able to do is scale our efforts. We haven't been able to address the insane housing shortage that we actually have for people with the lowest incomes in our community. So I think that we have a lot of the right ingredients, but the cake we're making isn't responding to the scale of the need.
So, you know, there are a lot of new sources of funding that are going to be coming on board to tackle homelessness. The city finally prevailed in challenging the 2018 Prop C lawsuit. The CARES Act allocated billions of federal dollars, and Biden just signed the American Rescue Plan on March 11th, which also included $50 billion for emergency housing and homelessness assistance. Jamie, I'm curious, let's say the region dropped, the region was given $500 million tomorrow. Okay. Where would you start?
I fantasize about that question every day. You know, there's a couple simple ingredients, like Tamika said. We know how to solve homelessness. One, you have to prevent it. And a lot of the resources coming down, we are getting to the homes, to the people who are poor, who are living in marginalized income brackets, and we need to shore them up. We need to make sure that they do not fall into street homelessness. So that would be step number one. Every home, every community member who's struggling to make the rent, to pay their bills, to infuse resources in so that we don't add to the homeless crisis. Number two, we have to house people, and we know how to do it. So when Tamika talks about scale, when we can break down bureaucracies, when we can make sure that all of the systems are talking to one another, our staff of 350 individuals house people every day. It takes rental assistance to access housing, and it takes services. It takes practitioners who they themselves have been homeless, who have experienced it before, and those two ingredients together really solve homelessness.
And you think that these, you know, all these new resources can actually put a dent in, you know, in solving it, or is it going to be another temporary Band-Aid that, you know, we look back as sort of a, you know, a missed opportunity, or not a missed opportunity, but lots of hope and, you know, not the results that we hope?
I think this is where Tamika's organization, All Home, really comes in. The struggle I have running a community-based organization that works within seven different counties and counts how many different municipalities, literally the systems aren't talking to one another. So when All Home comes in with a regional approach, that gives us, that gives me new hope. I always wonder if I in my lifetime or my kids' lifetime will see an end to people living outside. It's because of the regional approach that I have new hope, getting the resources in the hands of organizations, cutting the bureaucracy down. And I think, Tamika, you know, I'd be curious what your thoughts are on that question as well.
Yeah, no, it's so fitting, right? Because one of the challenges that we have in the region is that our systems were actually never designed to end homelessness. So we've been really designed to maintain it. And now the system is overloaded. You have people who need supportive housing. You have people with you know, as little as $400 could be rehoused and are cool. They don't need intensive supportive services. And so we actually, the challenge with the influx of federal resources, which we appreciate because now we actually have a federal partner to work with us. What we worry about is that we don't have the sort of capacity and community infrastructure to be able to use those resources over time, because many of the dollars are time limited and they're directed for specific purposes. We need flexible resources. We need time to integrate those resources into our communities of care so that organizations like Jamie, who does incredible work on the budgets that they have, when there is an influx, they can easily deploy those resources quickly where they need to go. And that, I think, is the challenge when you're in a stimulus environment trying to extract resources toward a problem that is really systemic in nature.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. This is Joseph Pache along with David Boyer. We're talking with nonprofit leaders and experts on housing the homeless, Tamika Moss and Jamie Almanza. Do you have a question or ideas to share about the Bay Area's homelessness crisis? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofbay@gmail.com. And you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. That "the" is missing there. So it's really hard to stumble over that one all the time. So, Tamika, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, people of color, especially African Americans and indigenous peoples, experience homelessness at higher rates than whites. The most striking disparity can be found among African Americans, who represent just 13% of the general population, but account for 39% of people experiencing homelessness and more than 50% of homeless families with children. So, Tamika, have we misrepresented homelessness by framing it as a poverty issue when it's really a function of structural racism? Or is this a both-and situation?
Yeah, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you have a lot of forces at play here that are generational in nature. Structural racism didn't just end after the Civil Rights Act was passed, right? We have that baked into, even today, some of our housing covenants and policies that are being practiced across the Bay Area. And I think the challenge we have is first acknowledging that structural racism still has implications in the way in which people access housing and access services and the entire system. But then secondly, once we acknowledge that that is in fact the case, then we need to do two things. We need to redress the racial disparities that exist. Because Joseph, I think you said it, this crisis is actually not happening to everyone. This crisis is happening specifically to extremely low income communities of color, primarily Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks. So if we can get comfortable with acknowledging that the folks directly impacted by this crisis are those people, then we can engage those folks around what do they need in order to resolve their housing crisis, and how do we incorporate their perspective and their realities into our policy making. And so to me, racial disparities in racial equity is not just a tagline. It's integral to how we perform our interventions, our systems, and our policies to actually ensure that we are not disproportionately impacting people of color.
Can you unpack for us the factors at play here? You mentioned issues around housing access in general, but say more about what kinds of structures have been in place that have really led to this overrepresentation of people of color in the homeless population across our country.
Well, I would also love to hear Jamie's perspective, but from my perspective, it kind of starts from, you know, redlining as a pretty common example. I think people listening kind of understand that there were government sanctioned covenants, laws and rules that prevented Black, Brown, and Indigenous people from purchasing homes in certain communities. And that worsened over time. I think one of the best examples of this story is In the Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. I think everyone should read that book because it gives you a Bay Area context of some of the discriminatory practices that have existed.
Yeah, we had him on our show when that book came out. It was a great,
right?
Great interview.
He's incredible, right? And he speaks very plainly about the realities that exist. It's not up for a morality evaluation. It's actually fact. And I think one of the challenges that we have is that many of these covenants were sanctioned by our government. So people who have distrust in the public sector around solutions to these structural challenges have a history that needs to be dismantled in order to facilitate partnership with our public sector, in order to, because in my mind, having been a public servant for much of my career, you can't scale the type of interventions that we need if you don't have the public sector at the table. That's city, county, state, and feds. Our community, our philanthropy and private sector have a role to play for sure, but I think some of those challenges are persistent and need to be reimagined by our public sector. The last thing I'd say, Joseph, is I think that there is an economic challenge here, that All Home really tries to blend housing security solutions with economic security solutions. We can't, sort of erase the oppression that has happened for Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks in our economy to be able to amass wealth. Wealth was primarily amassed through housing assets directly impacting BIPOC communities. So I think that there's a relationship between who has access to wealth and assets, who has access to housing, and those elements continue to underline why we have limited impact in the homelessness space.
Right. So not only the income inequalities that people keep talking about, but the wealth gaps, which are even more stunning.
Even more stark.
Yeah. And we haven't even touched upon, but the over-criminalization of black and brown communities and high incarceration rates and decreased access to quality health care. We could go on. The point I think you're making here is that we need to really look at all of the pieces of our social fabric that has been frayed and broken that would have otherwise preserved or been a safety net, so to speak, for communities of color that just doesn't exist or was just yanked away.
Yeah, I think that's a great summation. And in fact, I often say that street homelessness is the most visual manifestation of historic inequities in our society. And in California, it manifests in street homelessness. In other communities like where I'm from in Cleveland, it manifests in poverty. But I think this is our manifestation of poverty.
So, Jamie, I wanted to ask you as a on-the-ground provider of services, how are organizations serving people experiencing homelessness addressing racial disparities and implicit bias within their programs and policies? Because it's not just about the safety net and the social infrastructure and the compact writ large. It's really also about the homelessness services providers, right?
Yeah, and I think I can sum up this conversation in a beautiful story that actually does tie in the state Project Home Key funds that were granted recently. And so BACS created a project called Project Reclamation, and it was really an anti-gentrification project that it was about buying single-family homes in the neighborhoods in which the same community members grew up in generationally. And so we were able to buy 20 single-family homes in the last 3 months' time and really create permanent housing for the individuals and families that we're talking about. And so that's one creative strategy where we're reclaiming the lands in which people, you know, again, generationally came from and were booted out. And that's one solution of many. I think another solution, when I talk about prevention, you know, it's really preventing homelessness by getting money, infusing money into the hands of the community members that we're talking about. Oakland has an innovative pilot right now that takes after the Stockton pilot, really about bridging kind of the income gaps and getting resources into the community members' hands. There's so many creative opportunities to really think about how a service provider or homeless housing provider can use resources in a way that really fights the epidemic that we're talking about.
Yeah, Jamie, you mentioned something there. We had Oakland's Mayor Libby Schaff on last week, and she highlighted the successes of pilot programs that are providing universal basic income. And while she wasn't speaking specifically about people experiencing homelessness, she pointed out that individuals who receive UBI or universal basic income are more likely to gain employment compared to those who do not receive UBI, indicating that having a job and being given the support to kind of get to that place is a major stabilizing factor.
Yes. And we, you know, we've done similar pilots. And Tamika said it earlier, it's about flexible funding. And so sometimes, you know, if someone needs a pair of boots and that's the only thing getting in the way from them getting a construction job, right? We got to buy that pair of boots and get those boots in the hands of the person. That opens up all kinds of economic upward mobility. We know that truancy goes down if you can buy your kid a new pair of shoes because kids don't want to go to school if they have holy shoes. You know, we know incarceration rates, arrest rates go down when you really eradicate the poverty that we're talking about.
We have a caller online, Grace from San Francisco. You still with us?
I am.
Great. What's your question?
My question is, I would like to know exactly this word resources. How does the public get the itemization of our funds, our tax dollars, how it's going to be spent? Because as I understand it now, a person in a tent living can get a stipend in San Francisco for $518. I don't know how they do it, but they can get it. And so when you say resources, does that mean that the tents are going to be enabled continually? What do resources mean, and how do we as the public get the itemization of that budget? $50,000 goes to this. That's point one. Point two is that perhaps Sprung.com, who built those navigation centers on Division and on the Embarcadero for $100,000, at least the one on Division Street, perhaps they could be part of that budget. and build facilities outside of San Francisco County where the people that are really desperate. I've seen people inject needles in their neck in the middle of the street at a red light. I've seen them dying, literally, with 911 trying to revive them using Narcan at a red light. Perhaps Sprung.com could build facilities, many of them. It wouldn't be a condo. It wouldn't be, you know, a comfy house, but it would be shelter and it would be assessment outside of San Francisco County so that the streets here can get cleaned up. Because what has happened here, I've lived here 25 years, is unconscionable. And I want to know specifically an itemized line-by-line budget of where that money is going to be allocated.
Grace, we're going to have you cut it there because we want to get your answer and we're running late on the segment. Who wants to start?
Yeah, I can take a start. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the lovely things I appreciate about our government is transparency. And I would suggest, you know, you can put in a public records request in terms of budgetary kind of expenditures. So I think from the resourcing perspective, I think about it, you know, there's a lot of data and research that shows it actually costs a taxpayer more money to keep someone living outside in street homelessness than it does to more humanely house them. And so there's, you know, I think I would encourage when people are living outside, you know, many of the people you're talking about are suffering. Nobody wants to be homeless. I get that question all the time as a service provider. Well, are people making choices and would they choose to be homeless? Absolutely not. And so I think those are very good points you make in terms of how we can kind of shift the narrative in terms of not everybody that's street homeless is struggling with an addiction issue or a mental health disorder. Some are, but not everybody.
So I have a question for you, Tamiko. You've worked with governors, mayors in both San Francisco and Oakland and know the challenges facing local governments. I'm curious, without a metropolitan government like New York City, do the current organizations and structure actually have the power to hold specific municipalities accountable or not?
It's a great question. I think we don't have a regional governance structure as you identified. And so a lot of the land use policies, particularly pertaining to the development of housing, rests at the local level. And so one of the things I get asked all the time is, what can we do to solve this crisis? Well, what you can do is ensure that you are supporting any housing development that is being proposed at your city council, at your board of supervisors, at your planning commission, because the way that we end homelessness is housing, full stop. I don't care how many services one needs in order to stay housed and to facilitate success in their own lives. That is not the cause of homelessness. The cause of homelessness, particularly in the Bay Area, is that we have a dramatic shortage of deeply affordable housing that people can afford. And it is if we focused on housing as the primary indicator for solving homelessness, we know how to build support services around that housing in order to keep people housed. And there's no better example than some of the work that Jamie's doing. So I would say we need to have accountability from our state partners in order to incentivize local jurisdictions, city and county jurisdictions, to set goals and targets around reducing the racial disparities within their homelessness population, as well as getting as many of our neighbors housed as quickly as possible. And Jamie mentioned it at the top of this segment. We also need to be investing in permanent homes for everyone, as well as prevention. If we aren't doing those things in concert, then we will continue to have uneven and insufficient responses to this crisis.
Well, this is an ongoing conversation. We had so many other questions for you, but we're going to have to pause here for tonight. I want to thank our guests, Tamika Moss, founder and CEO of All Home, and Jamie Almanza, executive director of Bay Area Community Services, or BACS. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much, yeah.
A correction. A correction on what I said at the end of our first segment. The San Francisco Unified School District School Board meeting this month in April will happen tomorrow, April 6th and April 20th. I apologize for the misinformation there. So April 6th and April 20th for the school board meetings. Next up, Co-host Ethan Elkind sits down with Filipina-American artist Jennifer K. Wofford to discuss her new mural, Pattern Recognition, which is currently on display at the Asian Art Museum and can be seen at the museum's Hyde Street art wall.
All right, well, we're very pleased to be joined by Jennifer Wofford here on State of the Bay. Jennifer, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I wanted to first ask you about pattern recognition. And since we are an audio program, people can't see it unless they go check it out, which we, of course, encourage them to do. Can you describe the piece for our listeners?
Pattern Recognition is a mural that's about 7 feet tall by 36 feet wide. It is on the new Hyde Street art wall on the rear of the Asian Art Museum. So if you're at the Civic Center Farmers Market, for example, you could walk just to the top of the market and you'll see it just on the back of the museum right there. And it's a very colorful series of graphic patterns and name checks of some artists.
And so what inspired you to start working on it?
Pattern Recognition was inspired by a prior project, actually, where I had been dealing with this similar, very colorful graphic vocabulary for an installation dealing with the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, which I know has maybe nothing to do directly with Asian American culture or history. But it was a graphic vocabulary that I found really satisfying and joyful, and I wanted to incorporate it and adapt it for something new. So when the museum invited me to apply for this commission to do a mural, I thought about adapting these very fun, bright colors and patterns in an entirely new way, which is to say, take these other shapes that might be a little bit more generic, like stripes or polka dots, and turn them into a vocabulary that was quoting from the Asian Art Museum's collection or from the Asian communities just adjacent to the museum.
Well, I was going to ask about how the neighborhood influenced the work. So how did the Tenderloin, your sense of the Tenderloin, factor into the design?
Well, both the Tenderloin and South of Market areas are home to, you know, two of the most significant Asian communities in the Bay Area, or in San Francisco, certainly, where, you know, throughout the Tenderloin, you have a lot of folks from Vietnam and Cambodia, and certainly South of Market, there's a long history of the Filipino community having settled there. And so you don't see too many of those communities represented well in the Asian Art Museum collections, ironically. And the Asian Art Museum, to their credit, was really open to this conversation, which is not necessarily to shame them in any way for sins of omission, but to have a broader conversation about the work that is represented in the collection versus what is outside, and trying to bring those two things into one space on the wall of the museum itself.
And what about the choice of the bright colors? You mentioned that at the outset in describing it, and that's the first thing that really grabbed me, was just the brilliance of the colors. Was that, what was the thinking behind incorporating that color scheme? Or is that kind of how you always work, or was that particular to this project?
No, I actually don't work with this level of bright color very often, and certainly not in this particular style. This is fairly new for me. It's come up in the past couple years. And I would say the simplest answer is it just makes me happy. It makes an awful lot of other people happy. And it's a very specific balance of these bold, bright colors tempered with these moments of pure black and white as another graphic element that I think do a lot of that energizing work.
And I also wanted to ask you about the patterns that you selected for the piece. Are there any in particular that were particularly meaningful for you that you wanted to describe for our listeners?
The first pattern that comes to mind as most meaningful to me specifically is the one dead center, which is a reference to my mentor, the late artist Carlos Villa, who was a San Francisco native himself. He passed away about 8 years ago. In many ways, I credit him with my own journey as an artist. And so across the mural, you'll see there are 9 names, and these are all of Asian American artists of an earlier generation that all lived and worked here in the Bay Area. But Carlos is very near and dear to my heart. And so there's a very strange, mysterious looping pattern that appears just adjacent to his name. And I think in retracing his own mark-making, I think I felt a little closer to him in that process.
That's a really nice homage then for a mentor. And you mentioned these names, Carlos among them. How did you end up picking those 9 names? I mean, there are many Asian American artists in the Bay Area, so how did you get down to those 9?
It was difficult to choose the artists for this mural. I knew that it had to be only 9. And that was a brutal editing process, but I did consult with a number of different people in the Asian American arts community and historians of Asian American art, especially around the local community specifically. And I ended up deciding that it needed to be artists that were born pre-1940, because I think this is the generation that didn't really get as much acclaim as maybe they should have. They're not as uniformly recognized as being part of a broader Asian American community. And these are also folks who focused and committed their lives to their cultural work here in the Bay Area. Like, there are plenty of other Asian American artists who maybe were in the Bay Area for a couple of years and then decamped to New York or to Europe. But these are the folks that really committed to contributing to culture here.
And what's been the public reaction that you've gotten so far to those nine names?
Well, the public reaction has been largely positive. Most people have told me that it makes them feel very joyful. I've had a lot of very positive response from folks in the Asian American arts community and the broader Asian American community who just appreciate seeing these narratives so boldly presented on the museum wall.
And I'm guessing that you began this piece before some of the tumult that we've seen over the last year with COVID, and then more recently the increase in anti-Asian racism. And I'm wondering if that's influenced your work, and if your view of this piece has changed at all.
Yeah. This piece was developed before COVID hit and before we entered this more recent wave of sort of virulent anti-Asian racism. But I would say that what's happening now is only confirmation of a lot of decisions that I made around this particular mural and other projects that I've done in the past, which are very frequently about addressing marginalized narratives, things that people don't think of as truly American or universal enough, these kinds of nonsense things that people like to say to keep you in your box. And so it's, if anything, it's just been validating to have this work out in the world and have a whole nother way to have a conversation around this work with folks.
What's next for you? I mean, you have this project completed, and I'm sure, you know, you've had other things coming up in the pipeline, so to speak. So what can we expect?
I'm pretty excited about a private commission in a similar style that I'm about to start right now. And then I also just found out this morning that I'm likely to have gotten a grant for a project about the Filipino-American diver of Victoria Manalo Draves, who is a San Francisco native. And so this will be a more illustrative, figurative project. But I'm super excited to delve into her legacy, because she is one of those, I think, underappreciated legends of San Francisco history.
And given the recent events we were talking about, do you plan to incorporate current events, political events at all, into your art?
I think that my art is always inherently political in some way, shape, or form, whether it's performance work that I've done over the past four women's marches, which were largely about organizing women of color around specific issues of race and gender, to the kinds of narratives that I approach in my more straightforward visual projects. And so I don't know that this particular difficult moment we're going through changes what I've already been doing so much as it confirms why I do it.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
That was host Ethan Elkind's conversation with San Francisco artist Jennifer K. Wofford about her new mural, Pattern Recognition, which is on display now at the Asian Art Museum's Hyde Street Art Wall. For more information about Jennifer and a picture of the mural, please visit the State of the Bay website on klw.org or find her on wafflehouse.com. That's WOFFLE house.com.
Well, that is State of the Bay for this week.
We want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation, and I want to thank you, especially David, for joining me tonight.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. So I realize now just how hard you guys work. I've been sweating it over here for the hour, so, you know, keep on keeping on.
Great. Well, next Monday, hosts Ethan Elkind and Grace Swan will explore the state of sports with Ann Killian of the San Francisco Chronicle. They'll also talk about the return of tourism to the Bay Area. And I sit down with Emmy Award-winning director and cinematographer Peter Nix about his new film, Homeroom. If you have questions for any of our guests next week, email us at stateofbay@gmail.com or send us a tweet at stateofbay.
And for a link about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on klw.org.
Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper, Jillian Enblad, and Kendra Klang.
I'm David Boyer.
And I'm Joseph Pache. Good night, and thanks for listening.